The President of the United States talks to America's school children.
Class, we are honored today to have a very special guest. I am pleased to introduce to you President George Bush.
Thanks for allowing me to visit your classroom.
Oops, wrong president, and no controversy. Politics in the classroom today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 8th. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Lynn Scherr. We're both in for John Hockenberry this morning. Good morning, Lynn.
Morning, Todd.
Well, coming up this hour, are White House heads rolling because of Glenn Beck? We'll bring you one woman's story of a tragic visit home to Iran and why a New York judge is throwing out foreclosure filings.
But first, back to presidents talking to school children. We're here with Sherry Fowler, spokeswoman for Rockwall Independent School District in Texas. Sherry, how did George W. Bush get away with it and President Obama can't?
Well, I think that boils down to one word, and that's technology. Never before have we been able to just click a button and someone give a speech all across our classrooms, particularly in our district. Back when President Bush gave that speech, there weren't even TVs in every single classroom. So we would have had to tape that. A teacher would have had to bring it in and play it on a VCR. So we're dealing with an entirely different type of technological issue where you can see something in real time directly into every single classroom. And I think that makes all the difference to the families.
A difference in technology, maybe even in politics these days. Sherry Fowler, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
And in the headlines this morning, ahead of the president's national health care speech tomorrow night, he's meeting with top Democrats in the Oval Office today. Now that they're back from summer break, he wants Congress to stop debating health care plans and start voting. On the Hill, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus picks up right where he left off talking health care. Baucus today is working on a bill that would tax insurance companies to help pay for coverage for people who don't have health benefits.
More than half of the wildfires outside of Los Angeles have been surrounded. But a new flare-up has forced firefighters to abandon plans to set backfires to protect neighborhoods in the San Gabriel Valley. And in Northern California, San Francisco commuters will face more traffic jams this morning. Workers at the Bay Bridge couldn't finish repairing a crack in time to reopen it today. They're aiming for tomorrow morning. Overseas in Afghanistan, the latest election count gives President Karzai 54% of the vote so far. That's as election officials have ordered a partial recount, saying they found clear evidence of fraud at some polling sites.
Authorities have charged a Milwaukee man whose DNA they say links him to the murders of nine women dating back to 1986. He's been charged with two counts of homicide. More charges are expected later this week.
Markets were up more than 1% when they closed on Friday. After the holiday weekend, the Dow opens this hour at 94.41. The S&P starts trading at 10.16, and the NASDAQ begins at 20.19. President Obama's speech to school children goes out later today. While the text is out for you to read, it's still causing controversy in some circles. Where do you stand?
Hi, I'm a grandmother. My name is Nana. His speech to the children about going to school exempts their parents. Parents should take the responsibility to teach their children to stay in school and the responsibility. And the president should deal with issues of government.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Lynn Scherr. We're in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Todd.
Well, today is the day of President Obama's address to school children. That was supposed to be an uplifting start of the school year speech, and it's turned into a lemon for the White House. And we want to know where you stand.
Just the idea of having this speech by President Obama being discussed so much, it just goes to show that he's not your average president. And I think that shows in the fact that any other president in history that was giving a speech like this, it wouldn't be such a controversial thing.
We want to hear your take on the president's speech to school children today at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, yesterday, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs had this to say.
It's a sad state of affairs that many in this country politically would rather start an animal house food fight rather than inspire kids to stay in school.
All right. Well, how did something that was seemingly so well-intentioned here become in the words of the press secretary, an animal house food fight? Well, to find out, we're sitting down again with Sherry Fowler, spokeswoman for the Rockwall Independent School District in Rockwall, Texas. That's a suburb of Dallas, a state that has seen some of the most vocal backlash to the school address. Well, we're also joined by two parents. Brett Curtis is a father of three from Pearland, Texas. Brett does not want his children to watch the president's address today. Meanwhile, Michael Campo is a father of three as well. He's from Chicago, from Obama land, and he would like his children to hear the speech. Well, Sherry Fowler from down there in Rockwall, Texas, thanks for rejoining us. You were on yesterday. You're on again today. Now that you've seen the text of the speech, and parents, probably many of them have seen the text of the speech, it's been released by the White House, has their take on this changed at all?
Well, we actually haven't heard a whole lot of reaction that's different since the text has been posted. We do expect to have some additional phone calls this morning. Our policy is an opt-in policy, completely optional, but accessible to any student in our district. It'll play live on every campus in a central location. So since the text has been posted, we are expecting some additional phone calls wanting their students to hear that message in live time.
And you have an opt-in policy, meaning children's parents have to take action to opt them into seeing the speech?
That is correct.
Not the other way around. Why don't they opt them out? I don't want my kid to see the speech.
Well, actually, as we looked at a lot of things going on across the district, the fact that it's during lunchtime, we have standardized testing. We've been in school for 2 weeks. This will start our third week. So we have things already scheduled in the classroom. And then judging from our parent calls and what the feeling was, we just said logistically it's going to be easier to pull 4 or 5 students from a class to go to a central location than it would be to pull 20 kids out whose parents are skeptical in some way and want prior review and do something with them while the speech is going on. So it was strictly a logistical, practical decision to do the opt-in.
Okay, policy. Sherry Fowler, you mentioned prior review. I want to read just a line or two from the president's prepared remarks that the White House released. And Brett Curtis down there in Pearland, I want you to react to it. The president, according to these remarks, will say, but by the end of the day, the circumstances of your life, what you look like, where you come from, and how much money you have, what you've got going on at home, that's no excuse for neglecting your homework or for having a bad attitude. That's no excuse for talking back to your teacher, for cutting class, or dropping out of school. It's no excuse for not trying. Brett Curtis, down there in Pearland, Texas, we've given you some prior review there. What's wrong with that?
Well, originally, I think a lot of people were concerned about the political content with the curriculum that he'd put out with this speech. But reviewing the speech now, my reaction is that sounds like something a father might say to his child. And, that's what my job is. I'm a parent, and I feel like it's my responsibility to teach my kids the values of education and that my kid goes to school to get the education, not to be lectured by politicians and, to have a parenting role go on. And it seems to put the president up as somewhat of a father figure that's going to tell them, how to act and what their responsibilities are. And, along with the curriculum, I think that was, one of the things that's somewhat bothering is that this is more of a parenting role and setting up the president is, the president himself is somewhat glorified.
Well, then here's my question, Brett Curtis. If that's the way you feel about it, it's most certainly your right to feel that way. Why not let your children listen to it, have them come home, and then tell them he's just a politician? You don't take everything he says as gospel. He's not your father. I am. You should. Why isn't it a teachable moment? View all politicians with skepticism.
Well, when I went to school, I grew up during the Apollo space shots and the moon landing. I also grew up during the Vietnam War. I grew up when Nixon was president, and what we learned was that we should glorify our country. We should be proud patriots of our country. We should respect the office of presidency. But we learned in school and through life and the politics and the news and events of the years when I grew up that the president was fallible. And we saw a president resign. We saw the American public push back against the president's policies in Vietnam, and we learned that the president has to be restrained.
All right, I want to bring in Michael Campo from Chicago. That's Barack Obama's hometown, of course. Mr. Campo, you don't mind your children seeing the president's speech, even if he is being a bit parental. Is that correct?
Absolutely not. You know, quite frankly, at the end of the day, this is kind of a historic opportunity for children to actually interact in some capacity with the president, to listen to the president. In my recollection, I'm kind of a history buff. I don't think this has ever happened in the modern era where a president is directly speaking to the children of America. And, you know, I think that this president just can't cut a break. And it's kind of – it's becoming almost offensive at the way some of these people are treating and disrespectful to the office of the presidency and the president.
What's interesting to me is that the disrespect – I think there is a lot of disrespect for the office, and it seems to be coming from the right, and it's almost equal and opposite to the disrespect that the left had for George W. Bush when he was president. They seem to be countervailing forces. It's interesting to me.
You know, quite frankly, as an ex-Republican, I have to tell you that even during the Clinton administration, I never found this level of disrespect for the presidency.
All right, Sherry Fowler down there in Rockwall, Texas, I want to bring you back into this. What about the kids? Have the kids in your school district must be very well attuned to the controversy that's going on between the parents. Have the kids noticed each other, divided themselves at all based on you're seeing the speech, I'm not seeing the speech, you're allowed to see it, I'm not, your dad's right wing, my mom's left wing?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question because I'd have to disagree with your assessment. I have two kids myself in the school district, a sophomore in high school and a seventh grader, and we had a roundtable discussion about it and did they want to view it. And both my kids' assessment was, well, what class would I be getting out of? And so when we talked to them and their friends and just hearing from my own children, I think the kids are not as in tune. I think that this is a parental battle for the most part. You're talking about K through 12th grades. And so certainly our elementary students are not as attuned. You probably have some high school ones that are. But we're really not seeing that division in our schools. And I think hearing from both these parents is an excellent example of why a school district has to respond to this issue in a way that actually meets the needs of all the families, as opposed to just taking a side or the other.
This is Lynn Scherr joining in the conversation. Brett Curtis, let me go back to you for a minute. Just curious, would you have had any objection if President George W. Bush had wanted to speak to your kids in school?
I watched the George Bush speech, and he made a speech very similar and talked about education, and I think at the end of the speech, he spent a lot of time talking about drugs. But what President Bush didn't do was President Bush didn't direct a curriculum to all the school districts in the state of Texas.
No, but we're talking about what he said to the students. In other words, just the fact that President Bush spoke to the students was okay with you.
Well, when I watched the President Bush speech, my reaction is, why would the school district, and I don't know if they how the school districts handled it then and what he asked the school districts to do, but I wondered why they would have that, why the kids would want to see this, because or why this would be good, because it was a political speech to accomplish political goals of the president of the United States. And you know, that's how I felt about it, is that, you know, this was not valuable for my kids to be pulled out of their classes in arithmetic and reading and writing and the things. My wife is a teacher in Pearland, and you know, they have a very busy schedule. They can't afford to have all these competing priorities.
All right, Brett Curtis, a father of three in Texas. His kids are not seeing the president's speech. Michael Campo of Chicago, his kids are. And Sherry Fowler of Rockwall, Texas, spokeswoman for the Rockwall Independent School District. Thank you all for joining us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and today with Todd Zwillig, we turn now to Iran, recently the scene of violent protest after what some called a rigged presidential election, regularly considered a threat to enter the nuclear arms club, a critical player in any Mideast discussion. For some insight on what's going on in Iran, we welcome Haleh Esfandiari, An Iranian-American scholar who spent more than 105 days in solitary confinement in Iran after being charged with plotting to overthrow the Iranian government. She was arrested during her annual trip home to visit her mother. Her horrifying experience is documented in her new memoir, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. Welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your story is shocking. Your story is, as I said, horrifying. It seems like such a nightmare. Just briefly, what was it like being in that prison, being subjected to this barrage of questions?
It was terrible. It was horrifying. I was completely cut off from the outside world. I was in solitary confinement, and my interlocutors were the women guards of the ward and my interrogators.
And you were frequently blindfolded?
I was blindfolded any time I was taken for interrogation.
The sense of being totally cut off must have been among the most frightening things that you went through.
Sure, because my interrogators kept on telling me that nobody in the outside world cares for you, and the people who really care and would like to release you are us, and you need to cooperate with us.
They charged you with plotting to overthrow the government. Is that something you had done?
Of course not. I mean, there were these absurd allegations that I was part of a plot to overthrow the regime through a velvet revolution, you know, which I thought really was absurd.
What does your experience, which you have so eloquently and so graphically described in your book, what does your experience tell us about Iran today?
There is a sense of paranoia in the intelligence ministry and now among the revolutionary guards and also the President Ahmadinejad and his office that the United States is one way or the other set on overthrowing the Iranian government, and since the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it will not use military means to overthrow the regime, so therefore they will go through soft revolution.
So they are paranoid about what is happening in this country only, or in other countries as well, I assume, Israel as well?
I think they are paranoid about the West, basically, the United States and the Western countries trying to overthrow the regime through soft means. And Israel, of course, there is always the danger looming over their head that the Israeli might resort to a military strike against their nuclear facilities.
Halea Esfandiari, this is Todd Zwillick here.
Hi, Todd.
Hi. What were the circumstances of your release? Can you briefly tell us the story of your release? You were charged with plotting to overthrow the Iranian government, but released after, I guess, about 3.5 months, much, much shorter stay than one would expect for a treasonist. So what were the circumstances of them letting you go?
President Hamilton, the director of the Wilson Center.
Lee Hamilton, sure.
Had written a letter to Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, and had asked for my release on humanitarian grounds. And a couple of weeks after the letter arrived, Mr. Khamenei wrote back through the Iranian mission in New York to Mr. Hamilton, and it was the first time that the office of the leader of Iran, of the Islamic Republic, had answered and written to an American official.
What did they say to you? When did you find out you were going home?
Oh, I didn't find out until 3 weeks before I was released, because they came to me, my interrogators, and said that there has been such an exchange of letters, but the Iranians are expecting for Mr. Hamilton to write back to the leader and answer him. And I said, what do you want me to do from jail? You know, I haven't been in touch with anyone. They said, well, call your mother and explain to her. So I was allowed to make a phone call to my mother and then explain the situation. I said, there is an urgency for a reply. And apparently Mr. Hamilton then went to New York, replied to that letter, and then 3 weeks later, one afternoon, I was exercising in my cell. One of the women guard came and said, you are going to go for interrogation. And I said, interrogation? Okay, fine. So I went, and I was told I'm freed.
We should point out that there are currently still 4 Americans detained in Iran. 3 were detained on July 31st when they crossed into Iran while on a hike in the Kurdish section of Iraq. And 1 is Iranian-American who was arrested on the same charges as our guest. Haleh Esfandiari is director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. She has a new memoir out, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. Thank you for filling us in. Now let's check on some of the news stories we're following this morning.
All right, thanks, Lynn. President Obama will speak to the nation's school children today. Text of the speech was released by the White House. It encourages students to stay in school and respect their teachers. Some conservatives are calling the presidential address indoctrination. Some parents will not allow their children to watch the speech.
In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber struck an airport in Kabul today, killing civilians. NATO forces have a base at the airport. Firefighters are still battling the wildfire north of Los Angeles in California. It's more than 50% contained.
Transit officials say the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge will be closed for another day. They hope to reopen the bridge tomorrow.
And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So all day today, we're talking about President Obama's speech to school kids at noon Eastern. Still, it's causing controversy in a lot of circles. Where do you stand on this?
This is Chris from Detroit. The other thing this Obama speech controversy demonstrates is how beholden the media is to right-wing lunacy.
All right, speaking of right-wing lunacy, who helped take down Obama's green job czar? Here's a hint.
Get off my phone!
That's Glenn Beck. Coming up, we'll talk about how the radio host from Fox News is not having a problem being heard. Coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, Todd Zwillick here. With Lynn Scherr, we're both filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, when the White House green jobs advisor Van Jones resigned on Saturday, it was clear that this was a story about cable television as much as it was about politics, and here's why. According to many news reports, Van Jones came undone after Fox News personality Glenn Beck began looking for dirt on Jones. Well, here's a simple fact about it. Glenn Beck's show on Fox draws around 3 million viewers a night. Now, for those of you who don't watch television or don't watch Fox, here's a little taste of Glenn Beck responding to a caller who disagreed with his views on health care.
Kathy, get off my phone! Get off my phone, you little pinhead! I don't care! You people don't care about the trillions! Get off my phone!
What do you think he really meant?
It doesn't sound that much different from what Howard Stern does on the radio, but Glenn Beck has a huge politically charged audience. At a time when President Obama seems to be struggling to get his message across, even from the bully pulpit, Glenn Beck has no problem being heard loud and clear, especially when he yells that loud. Well, to help us answer when Glenn Beck got so powerful and why, we're joined by Michael Harrison, the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine. He's here in the studio. And also by Robert Thompson, professor of television and radio and film at the Syracuse University, where he is also director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. Michael Harrison here in the studio. Is this just about ratings? Does Glenn Beck yell and scream because people just like to hear it, and it's just about getting eyes on the screen? What is this?
Well, certainly not being his shrink, I don't know how he feels
sure.
deep inside, but
sure.
I would say that by and large, it's about ratings, it's about revenue, it's about show business, and that is the primary mission of commercial media in America today.
What
I say that objectively. I'm not being subjective.
Okay, well, what does the business the business, capital B. What do they think of Glenn Beck? Are people envious about his audience? Is that all it's about? Are they
in commercial media? Without making it sound like it's totally crass, I would say that primarily they're envious, and that he's admired for being able to take it up a notch in terms of getting attention, getting media buzz, having an impact on public policy and the news itself, which is a...
And why isn't that a crass thing to say? I mean, if it's all about money, if it's all about bottom line, is there no area here for you know, actual public discourse? Or?
Well, I believe it's a very, very murky situation. And I don't believe this is new. I just think it's now. Now always seems more profound. And it's more heightened as we get deeper into the 21st century. We're becoming less self-conscious about our motives in terms of public discussion. Politics has become like football or baseball, a spectator sport, mm-hmm. and entertainment as much as it's become serious business of running the country. And the line between the two is very blurry.
All right, Robert Thompson on the phone, professor of television and radio and film at Syracuse. Let me play a bit of tape from Glenn Beck. I want to get your reaction to it. I'll get Michael's reaction to it as well. Glenn Beck doing what he does best, talking about the president of the United States.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture. I don't know what it is.
Robert Thompson in Syracuse, I said before, it doesn't sound too terribly different from what Howard Stern used to do, still does, on the radio. But Glenn Beck has set himself up as a real nemesis of the president. How did he do it?
He has, and let's remember, though, that Glenn Beck is also a comedian. So we know that part of this is show business. We know that he's good at it. I think, you know, your colleague asked the question after we heard that screaming rant, what do you suppose he means, or what do you suppose
right.
he thinks? I think part of what makes Glenn Beck and guys like him, Rush and Hannity and O'Reilly and so forth, so satisfying to their audiences is you always know exactly what they mean. They are so fundamentalist in their beliefs, and by that I don't mean fundamentalist Christian. I mean fundamentalist. They know what they think, and they say it, and they say it really, really loud, and that is highly satisfying to their listeners and viewers. And let's remember, they don't have to appeal to all of us. They don't care if they alienate 90% of the population. Glenn Beck's audience is considered a big hit at 3 million. We sometimes forget that there are 300 million people in this country.
And it's the thing that always gets me is where we are now, both in television and in much of radio, is nothing is subtle. There are no grays. Everything is either black or white. No racial pun intended here in terms of what Mr. Beck was quoted as saying earlier.
I don't think anybody may have ever used the word subtle and Glenn Beck in the same paragraph, much less the same sentence.
Well, Robert Thompson, let me ask you quickly. I'd like to hear Michael address the same question. It's the chicken and egg question. Does Glenn Beck rail against the president, call him a racist, a Marxist, a socialist, a Nazi, if he did in fact call him a Nazi? I don't remember if he did that one. Does he do it because he knows it's what his audience wants to hear, or is the audience revved up and they think these things because Glenn Beck said it?
Well, it's like the chicken and egg question in that the two of them are forever in a dance and nobody's leading. I mean, I think probably by the kind of normalizing and institutionalizing and verbalizing those feelings, to some extent he may be quote-unquote causing them in more people. But at the same time, clearly there are a lot of people out there who want to hear it. So I think the two of those are forever in a symbiotic relationship.
And that's Robert Thompson, professor of television, radio, and film at Syracuse University. Michael Harrison, publisher of Talkers Magazine. What do you think about the chicken and egg here?
I do think it's a symbiotic relationship. I agree almost completely with the professor. It's like a mirror. You look in the mirror, you see what you look like, but it influences you to make a change with your hair, your makeup, whatever. And that's the way the media is. It reflects society, and then society takes a lead from that reflection. It's a two-way street. It's media theory. It's complex.
So 3 million, just real quickly, 3 million is big ratings in cable news business, but the president has the bully pulpit. How did did he lose at least part of the message to a guy with 3 million viewers?
Because the media today echoes what these niche media do. Somebody could do something on the internet that's very isolated, and then everybody plays it over and over and over, and it amplifies the message and gives the impression it's larger than it really is. And that's a phenomenon that we see today, as evidenced by the fact that we're talking about Beck's message here on a medium that is targeted to a whole different group.
All right. That's Michael Harrison, publisher of Talkers Magazine, a leading trade publication for the talk, radio, and television industry. We also heard from Robert Thompson from Syracuse University. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Now let's check in on today's top news stories.
Todd, in Afghanistan, the latest election count gives President Karzai 54% of the vote so far. That's as election officials have ordered a partial recount, saying they found clear evidence of fraud at some polling sites. In Iraq, the U.S. military says four American soldiers have been killed by roadside bombs in Baghdad and the north of the country.
Back in the U.S., aides say President Obama will declare it's time to move from debating to voting in his big health care speech tomorrow. Today, he meets with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
Finally, Tropical Storm Fred is getting stronger in the eastern Atlantic. It may become a hurricane in the next few days. And those are some of the top stories we're watching.
All right. The financial crisis started 1 year ago. We're talking about it all week. And coming up, is the housing market getting back on track? We'll find out here in just 10 minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This recession we're in is a global one. It's turning lives upside down everywhere from Wall Street here in New York to the Great Wall of China. Well, a new report commissioned by our partners, the BBC World Service, looks at the effect of the crisis on migration, the global movement of people from one country and one economy to another. Well, joining us to talk about the impact of the global recession on migration is Michael Fix, a co-author of the report. Michael Fix is the Senior Vice President and Director of Studies at the Migration Policy Institute. And for an international perspective, we're also joined by Andrew Walker, the BBC's economic correspondent. Michael, in the U.S., of course, we think about migration in terms of migration, immigrants from Mexico and from Latin America flooding into our country to work jobs, work farms, work in stores, work in the service sector. Has that flow of workers remained as high as we always thought it was?
Two things happened in the recession. First thing is that new inflows from Mexico fell off, and fell off substantially. So where we would have expected there to be about 12.7 million immigrants in the Mexican immigrants in the United States, we really see that there's about 11.5 million.
So fewer jobs, people just aren't coming as much.
Yeah, fewer jobs, people aren't coming as much. But there's a second part to the story, which is a somewhat more surprising and I think even a little more interesting story, which is that return migration from Mexicans to Mexico, Mexicans in the United States to Mexico, has stayed about steady since the recession started. Given the economics of in the United States, and given the extraordinary unemployment in the construction industry and some of the other industries in which Mexicans have been concentrated, you might expect higher return flows.
So we would think that some people are waiting it out, but because of stimulus and construction in places like Louisiana, road work, a lot of immigrants from Mexico still have work they can do.
It's not clear that that's what's happening. What we really are seeing is that unemployment among the Mexican population and the Central American population since the start of the recession has doubled. And so our hypothesis is that Mexicans in the United States, like immigrants in Spain and like immigrants in many other countries, are hunkering down, are exposed to substantial hardship, and are hoping for the storm to pass.
All right. Michael Fix, Senior Vice President and Director of Studies at the Migration Policy Institute, co-author of the report commissioned by the BBC that we're talking about. Thanks for joining us. I want to turn to Andrew Walker, who is from the BBC, economics correspondent. Andrew, briefly, we've of course been talking about the flow from over the border between the U.S. and Mexico. What are the main trends we're seeing globally? Certainly workers migrate all over the world during a recession.
Globally, the typical pattern is very much what Michael was describing for the U.S. and Mexico. Fewer people are moving because there are fewer jobs in the traditional destination countries for migrants. But equally, in most cases, an awful lot of people are staying put. Now, there are a few really quite striking exceptions to that pattern, and one of them is right here in the UK. For many years, we've had an awful lot of people in the new European Union countries, in Eastern Europe, for example, particularly Poland, have come here to work in the construction industry and some other sectors. Many of them have gone home. And one of the really striking factors behind that, I think, is that, of course, if they do go back to Poland and then subsequently decide they want to come back to the UK, they have a straightforward legal right to do so. So they don't have to worry about the difficulty of returning if they do go home.
All right, Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent. We've also seen interesting trends of some countries paying people to go back to their country of origin, all part of global migration trends in the recession. Thank you.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Sherrod with Todd Zwillick. We're looking back at the financial crisis 1 year later. Coming up, is the housing market getting back on track? We'll talk more in a minute. We're also talking all day about President Obama's speech to school children. It's still causing controversy in some circles. We want to know where you stand.
This is Barbara in Detroit. I just wanted to say that the speech that President Reagan gave when I was a child, or any of the presidents gave when I was a child, when I started school on any given year, were not a big deal. And I don't understand why everybody has to have pre-screening for Obama's.
And is anybody listening? Tell us your take on the president's speech to school children. And if you're a parent, will you let your kid listen? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, some of the stories we're following this morning. The president will meet with top Democrats today as they get back to work from their summer break. That's ahead of his national health care speech, where aides say the president will get more specific about health care reform. The Senate Finance Committee meets today to talk about their own health bill. Two committee members, Chairman Max Baucus and Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, are now pushing for a plan that would create nonprofit health care co-ops instead of a nationalized health care system.
Meanwhile, in Mexico, the attorney general who was leading the battle against drug cartels has resigned. That's amid charges that his top confidant was taking bribes. Former Mexican cabinet member Juan Hernandez says the resignation is good for the country.
They have this new face, fresh person coming in who has a past that is totally clean, according to most people's perspective, I think is very positive.
More than 13,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence in Mexico since 2006.
According to a new study from our partner, the BBC, fewer migrants are looking for work in other countries because of the global recession. The study shows the number of Mexicans moving to the U.S. has fallen by 40% since 2006. GM might not be rid of Hummer just yet. China's Commerce Ministry wants more details on a bid to sell Hummer to a Chinese manufacturer. Chinese authorities have to approve the deal.
And it's departure day at the International Space Station. Space Shuttle Discovery will pull away this afternoon, ending a resupply visit that lasted just over a week. The shuttle will bring home 7 astronauts and a Buzz Lightyear doll that was launched last year. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our system basically failed its most fundamental tests. It was too fragile, too vulnerable to shocks.
We're going to have to save those banks.
Save those banks.
Save those banks.
Even if we cashier out the guys that took the big bonuses.
When they fail, they get a bonus. The taxpayer gets the bill.
Oh, you probably recognize that music. All week long, we are reviewing the year that marked the beginning of the financial meltdown and the recession that we continue to live through, or try to live through. Today, we're focusing on the housing market, and we have a roundtable of guests with us this morning. Robert Shiller is a professor of economics at Yale and the co-creator of the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. He was among the very few experts who foresaw this housing crisis. For an in-the-trenches perspective, Judge Arthur Schack of the New York State Supreme Court joins us. Every week, banks come to his court with foreclosure papers. We also welcome back Pamela Zombeck. She and her husband are struggling to hold on to their home in Salem, Massachusetts. We first heard from them in March. Welcome to all of you. And Professor Shiller, let me start with you. You're the guy who back in 2005 warned of a housing bubble. What did you see that others didn't?
Well, I think the psychology of the situation is something that is apparent to a lot of people who were participating in the market, but wasn't apparent to most economists because it's not part of their theory. Bubbles are not even in most textbooks, but that's what we had. And I've than studying behavioral economics have a different perspective.
Judge Schack, let me go to you. Our partner, The New York Times, has reports that you've thrown out 46 of the 102 foreclosure motions that have come before you. How come?
Because the papers aren't completed in a facially sufficient manner. In other words, you know, I have the view that if you're going to take away somebody's home, that you have to present it. You have to present a case that will allow me to do that. So to remove someone from their house and to prove that there should be a foreclosure, and most of these cases are on default. That's why I'm going to come back to that. You have to show me there's a mortgage, you have to show me there's a default, and you have to prove to the court that you own the mortgage at the time the case commenced. So if those things can be done, the foreclosure is granted. However, a lot of the paperwork that I find from banks is insufficient. It's not accurate. There's sloppiness. So I believe there has to be a level playing field for homeowners as well as banks.
Judge Arthur Schack, the New York State Supreme Court, speaking to us now. And now let's go to a homeowner. Pamela Zombeck, you and your husband are really working hard to hold on to your house in Salem, Massachusetts. Tell me what's happening and how things are going for you.
Well, we waited 2 months from May, and we had applied for the Making Home Affordable modification in March. After a lot of delays and stalls and lost paperwork and going back and forth in May, we learned we did not qualify because we did not have sufficient disposable income. In June, we were offered a Making Home Affordable modification that is $100 less than what we were paying, and we were paying at 7.44%. So while they reduced our interest, they increased our principal by $12,000 to $15,000. And we can't do that. I'm still unemployed. We're in the mess because of a job loss.
So are you, in fact, facing foreclosure right now?
Yeah, we learned that they did. The loan servicer went ahead and filed a petition to foreclose unbeknownst to us, even though we're still in the process of negotiating this loan.
Okay, you're in Massachusetts. Judge Schack, you're obviously in New York. It's different places, different rules. But what can they do? Anything at all? Or what should the judge be looking for?
Well, in New York State, we have, depending on the situation, if someone has a subprime mortgage or a high-interest mortgage, as defined by law, and I'm not going to get into definitions because they're too complicated.
But thank
you. You meet those definitions, there has to be a mandatory conference in which a homeowner can come to court with the lender and try to work out a loan modification if it's possible. On the other hand, if someone gets papers and don't fall into those categories, I think it's incumbent upon them to come to court with or without a lawyer, and we have volunteer lawyers who do assist people who can't afford lawyers, and we try to work out loan modifications. Unfortunately, too many people don't avail themselves of this, but if they do, we try to save people's homes.
Professor Robert Schiller at Yale, what kinds of rules, regulations, and maybe even behavioral adaptations need to be put into place so that this doesn't happen ever again?
Well, for the future, I wrote in my book, Subprime Solution, I think we have to have a fundamental change in our mortgage institutions. The workouts have to be pre-planned. We're coming into this all after the fact, too late. It should be automatic. And we have to figure this all out and cost it out. But automatic, when home prices fall or when people become unemployed or incomes fall, that there should be some adjustment in the mortgage.
Whose fault is it ultimately? Is it about the exuberance of the consumers, people just dying to buy those houses, or was it the greed of the guys on the other side?
Well, I think that it's a question of financial progress. We've seen innovations in our financial institutions at various times in history, notably in the last big housing crisis in 1933, the government under Roosevelt really created the fixed-rate mortgage. Before that, they all were floating-rate mortgages. Mm-hmm. Well, you had to renew the mortgage every 3 to 5 years. So we saw big progress then, and I'm hoping that in this crisis we're going to rethink our mortgage institutions so that there will be we won't have this problem again if we plan the workouts in advance.
And that's looking long into the future. Pam Zombeck in Salem, Massachusetts, you've got an immediate problem on your hands. What would you like the Obama administration to do? What do you want to happen?
I really want them to put these lenders and loan services under a microscope. They accepted TARP funds, And they're turning around and raising principal and doubling fees and playing all sorts of games. They're still extracting the maximum they can out of people that truly, we didn't buy a home beyond our means. And we worked our butts off to get refinanced, and we were refinanced. I just lost my job. That's why we're in this mess. I don't think there's any accountability, and I don't think there's a hard line to oversight, and here's what you guys are going to do.
Pamela Zambach from Salem, Massachusetts, good luck to you. Thanks also to Judge Arthur Schack from New York State Supreme Court and Professor Robert Schiller at Yale. Tomorrow, we look at the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
So, Lynn, we're getting great response today about President Obama's speech to school kids at noon Eastern. Here's an interesting story of why one school might not play the speech.
My son is in a Detroit public school. It's mostly African-American school in the inner city. His school hadn't realized that the speech was going on. They didn't have any plan to play the speech. They didn't know when they were going to play the speech or if they were going to play the speech. And I'm furious because now we're being lumped in with all these crazy people who chose not to play it.
All right, tell us what you think. Go to the website, thetakeaway.org. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the phone number. Tell us what you think about whether or not kids should hear the president's speech at noon Eastern. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Lynn Scherer, and this is The Takeaway.
The president's friends think he's been speaking softly for long enough. It's time to bring out the big stick.
We've been fighting for quality, affordable health care for every American for nearly a century, since Teddy Roosevelt. Think about that. Long time.
Now, Mr. President, your opponents already beat you to the Teddy Roosevelt reference.
It is time, America, that we question with boldness. We speak without fear, while basing it all in fact. Walk softly and carry a big stick.
Well, Glenn Beck of Fox News is the one who's been taking a stick to the president lately. Well, whether he's been walking softly or speaking softly, as Teddy Roosevelt put it, it's time for the president to try turning up the volume. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 8th. I'm Lynn Scherer, joined by Todd Zwillick. We're in for John Hockenberry. Morning, Todd.
Morning, Lynn. Coming up this hour, the stories behind the unemployment numbers, making do in a recession-era Las Vegas, and why depression could become the world's biggest health problem. But first, President Obama speaks to Congress tomorrow night. We're speaking with Scott Rasmussen, president of Rasmussen Reports. Based on his latest poll numbers in this health care debate, Scott, does the president have the juice to get the public behind him with this speech tomorrow?
The short answer is he could. His poll numbers have been slipping. Right now it's at 49% job approval among likely voters. But while that's slipping, those aren't bad numbers. The president has a great forum. He has the big bully pulpit. If he has a message that can connect in a way that he hasn't so far in the health care debate, he can turn this around and pass health care reform. Might look a little different than what's in Congress right now.
Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Reports, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
And in the headlines, Todd, the president is trying to break the logjam in Congress over health care. He's meeting with top Democrats in the Oval Office today ahead of his big health care speech tomorrow night. He's expected to say it is time to stop debating and start voting on a plan. But first, it's back to school for President Obama. In just a few hours, he'll give a national address to school kids from a high school in Washington, D.C. The president will tell children to stay in school and remind them, quote, if you quit on school, you're not just quitting on yourself, you're quitting on your country, end quote.
Overseas in Afghanistan now, election officials have ordered a partial recount, saying they found clear evidence of fraud at some polling sites. The Complaints Commission says a recount should be done at any polling station where one candidate got more than 95% of the vote. Reports show incumbent President Hamid Karzai won 100% of the votes at numerous polling stations. Staying in Afghanistan, a suicide bomber attacked the main airport in Kabul today, killing at least two civilians. NATO forces have a base at that airport. Back in the U.S. at the Supreme Court, newly minted Justice Sonia Sotomayor will be officially commissioned today.
Thanks, Todd. Markets were up more than 1% when they closed on Friday. After the holiday weekend, the Dow opens next hour at 94.41, S&P 1016, and the Nasdaq begins at 2019. President Obama's speech to school children goes out later today. While the text is out for you to read, it's still causing controversy in some circles. Where do you stand?
Hi, my name is Ron Harmon. I believe many parents feel that they have a president that doesn't look like them, and they don't want their children to hear from him. They don't want to hear from him themselves. They just want to shut it out and pretend that he's not president.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Lynn Scherr. We're both in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Lynn.
Morning, Todd.
It's official. Summer vacation is over. It's my first day back at work.
I can't stand it. I need at least one more ear of corn, lots more tomato, another swim in the pool. It's a killer.
I need another 6 hours of sleep, I guess. Another story. Well, the pools are closed and the kids are on their way back to school, and Congress is coming back to Capitol Hill this very morning. President Obama tomorrow will try to take back control of the health care debate in a primetime address tomorrow night to a joint session of Congress and a television audience. In what may be a bit of a preview to that speech, here's the president speaking to the AFL-CIO in Cincinnati yesterday.
The Congress and the country have now been vigorously debating the issue for many months. The debate's been good, and that's important because we've got to get this right. But every debate, at some point, comes to an end. At some point, it's time to decide. At some point, it's time to act.
Well, the president thinks that time to act is right now. And joining us this morning, we want to have a little bit of a roundtable. And joining us is Peter Baker, White House correspondent for our partners, the New York Times, Jay Newton Small, Washington reporter for Time Magazine, and Scott Rasmussen, president of Rasmussen Reports. He's a pollster. Good morning, Scott. Let me start with you in the latest poll numbers. The president has slipped in July. We all know that. How much did he slip, and where does he stand right now?
Well, the president's numbers slipped a little bit beginning at the start of July when bad unemployment news came out. At that point, in our tracking polls, he was at 53% support among likely voters. He's lost about 4 points over the summer, down to 49% right now. The big shift, though, he's been gaining support among Democrats. They continue to support his programs enthusiastically, including health care reform. He has been losing ground among the unaffiliated voters, and that's potentially dangerous politically.
All right, Peter Baker, New York Times, 49% overall. The president still strong with his Democratic base, but not as strong with the moderate or so-called unaffiliated voters. Does that tell us anything about the tack that he takes in his primetime joint congressional address tomorrow night?
Well, I think it tells us that he wants to, as you played in the clip, get this debate over with and move on. You know, at this point, he's not going to get everything he wants. They know that. What they want to do is be able to pocket a win and build momentum again. You know, if this continues to drag out over the full fall, it has a real cost to it. There's a whole lot of things on his plate, a lot of things on his domestic agenda that he'd like to be again pushing forward, and nothing happens basically until health care is done. So, you know, there's going to be a somewhat scaled back version of his ambitions. But, you know, he's still got a pretty strong level support, certainly compared to the last president. I think he plans to try to use that as much as he can to leverage for his agenda.
All right, Jay Newton, Small Time Magazine, you're here with us. Scaled back, you know, Robert Gibbs said several weeks ago that we're not just going to pass sort of some milquetoast kind of bill and slap a V for victory on it and call it health care. Can Robert Gibbs, White House Press Secretary, still be confident that that's not what's going to happen, or does this scaled back mean something way scaled back? Do we know yet?
Well, we don't know yet. Senator Baucus, who's the chairman of the Finance Committee, floated a draft form of his bill this weekend.
Put it out on a Saturday, which is unusual. He's in a hurry.
Yeah, well, he's got a lot of pressure on him to pass something. It's the sort of last best hope of doing something bipartisan. Otherwise, they really will have to do something very scaled back, because they really, if they go it alone, they can't go it big and huge the way they want to do it.
And one of the big issues, Peter Baker from New York Times, the public plan. Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, his version, his draft, his proposal that he finally put out has no public plan, doesn't even have a co-op in it. Is the public plan sort of officially dead at this point, or unofficially dead?
No, I don't think yet. I mean, I think that, look, Baucus' bill is probably the most important one, but it's one of five bills on the Hill right now. You've got a situation where a lot of people say the Senate won't pass a plan that has a public option in it. This is, of course, a government-run health care plan that would compete with private insurers for people who small businesses that can't find insurance on the market right now. But on the other hand, in the House, the liberals, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, say no plan will pass that doesn't have a public option. So the real goal at this point is to get whatever version they can get to a conference committee and then work it out. That's the point at which the House and Senate will figure out the final elements of what's in the plan that will come before both of them for a final passage.
Peter, it's Lynn Scherr. I think one of the most interesting aspects of this whole thing is the lessons learned from the last time we had a big attempt at health reform, which, of course, was the Clinton administration. What do you think is the number one thing the Obama administration has learned?
Well, the health care is hard, and that even a popular president coming in with what he assumes is a mandate can't just snap his fingers and make it happen. I mean, 75 years this has been going on. Democrats have been trying for some variation of this, some Republicans as well. I think, you know, there have been tactical lessons. One was the Clintons would often, be said to have let too much details into their plan, not give Congress any room. I mean, frankly, Congress told them to do that, but that was a lesson that the Obama people took the other direction and gave Congress a lot of running room to run the plan. That's sort of a conventional Washington wisdom right now, that they didn't give enough details themselves to control that debate. But they are further along than Clinton's got. They do have four different bills, and now a fifth one, at least, possibly the other way, that have made it out of a committee. They still have, some momentum in a way that Clinton never really built up on health care. So it's early to say, and I think Scott said this earlier, that if they get a bill through by the end of the year that looks credible, it looks like it's a significant bill, we're not going to remember this turmoil now. If they don't, then we're definitely going to remember it, because it's going to be a turning point.
All right, Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Reports, you're a pollster. We talked about some of the president's top-line numbers. How are his coattails? And I ask that, he's talking to members of Congress. He's got these factions in Congress, as Peter and Jay mentioned. How are his coattails doing in the districts of moderate Democrats or in the districts of liberal Democrats, where he needs to win them over to one side or the other?
Well, the only good thing you can say about the president's numbers as they relate to Congress right now is that the midterm elections are 14 months away. Everywhere we look, there has been some problem for the Democratic Party, whether it's at the Senate races and some of the various districts, and especially among those who are most at risk, the districts that were carried by John McCain in 2008, people who have been newly elected in the last couple of years. Right now, the president is generally a drag on those races. The health care debate is generally a drag on those races. But, this is why you deal with these issues in the off years. The party in power wants to get these controversial, difficult issues out of the way so they have time to do some damage control. We don't have any idea what this will look like in November of 2010.
All right, so J. Newton Small, Time Magazine, what does the president try to do tomorrow night in front of the joint session of Congress? Does he try to shame them into action, that the health care situation is just intolerable? Does he try to rally the troops? Does he inspire them? What is he supposed to do?
Well, he's doing all of those. He needs to get everybody on board, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. He needs to really hit the reset button.
Well, Republicans aren't going to get on board, are they? I mean, certainly House Republicans have shown maybe four of them, if they're lucky, they're not getting on board.
No, but Senate Republicans, obviously there's the three Senate Republicans who are still negotiating with the president. You've got Chuck Grassley of Iowa, you've got Mike Enzi of Wyoming, and Olympia Snowe of Maine. So those three Republicans are still negotiating, and those may come with a few more moderates that they're still aiming for. I mean, they've got till September 15th, this deadline that they're working on, to try and get a bipartisan bill. And
right,
that's so, really
so the fact
part
that,
of his audience, them and Democrats.
And the fact that Max Baucus, the chairman of the committee, has released this proposal, that doesn't necessarily mean those so-called Gang of Six negotiations are over, right?
No, I mean, this proposal was to them. I mean, this proposal was described to me as full of stuff that they've been negotiating for months and months, that is full of stuff for these three specific Republicans, and that this is aimed at getting them on board and getting them to agree to a deal.
All right. The president speaks tomorrow night before Congress to try to regain control of the health care debate. Sort of two immovable objects there. Progressives who say the public option has to get out of the House conservatives who say it will never get out of the Senate. We'll see how it works out. Scott Rasmussen, president of Rasmussen Reports. Peter Baker is White House correspondent for The New York Times. And J. Newton Small is Washington reporter for Time Magazine. Thanks to you all.
And Todd, we've been talking all day about President Obama's speech to school children. It is still causing controversy in some circles. Where do you stand? Doreen emails us. Since when has it become controversial for the president to make a speech to school children, especially since the text of the speech was pre-released? I'm an atheist, she writes, and had opted out of prayer hours offered at my public school growing up. It is not a protest-worthy issue if it's optional. Indeed. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And coming up, unemployment is the highest it's ever been in 26 years. Bad news, or is there some good news there? We'll find out more next on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Now on Friday, we learned that the economy lost another 216,000 jobs in August. And whenever Americans are losing jobs, that's simply unacceptable. But for the second straight month, we lost fewer jobs than the month before, and it was the fewest jobs that we had lost in a year.
That was President Obama addressing the AFL-CIO in Cincinnati yesterday. I'm Lynn Scherr in with Todd Zwillick for John Hockenberry. And the president, optimistic words from the president, but accurate. In fact, unemployment numbers last week showed the jobless rate in this country is at its highest since 1983, 9.7%. And that is not even the whole picture. It only counts those who are actively looking for work, which means those folks so hopeless that they've given up their job search altogether are not even included in government data. And when positive economic signs tempt these folks back into the job market, the official employment rate could actually go up. Louise Story is a Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and she joins us in the studio. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
So we talk about unemployment as a lagging indicator. This one feels like it's a dead stop. I mean, if in fact the numbers aren't even fully accurate, what have we got going on? What are the real numbers?
Well, we've got this mushy group of people who are not counted as unemployed because they're not looking. However, if you go ask them, many of them may tell you, yeah, I'm unemployed. I mean, I'd love to have a job. If the economy were good, I would look. But instead, I'm not looking.
Let's just get it straight. The official way that we count unemployment is people who are looking for a job within the last 4 weeks. Is that correct?
That's right. So that does not count. That does not count someone who looked, you know, a month and a half ago. So the Labor Department breaks these people out. They count people who looked in the last year, but not in the last 4 weeks. And that number of people has about doubled from where it was before the recession. That's almost 800,000. But then they count an even larger group of people who they say probably would work in a good economy, and that number is up to 2.3 million.
So what's the real employment rate if you count all these people in?
Depending on how you define it, if that 2.3 million, if you include that, it's 11%, which would be an even larger record. But there's some economists who point to other people and say it could be up to 15%. For instance, if someone's consulting a couple hours a week, you know, it could be that depending on how they're classified, they're not counted as unemployed, but they feel pretty unemployed because they're only getting a few hours of work that week, and they
right.
like to work full time.
And then more discouraging statistics from Manpower Inc., which has released a new survey. Give us the headline on that.
So of the employers who are surveyed, most of them, 69%, say we're not changing anything in October. We're not hiring. Yes, we're not going to let more people go, but we're not hiring. You've got 14% saying we're going to let people go, 12% say we're hiring, but the net is a loss of 3%, which is the biggest monthly loss since 1962.
And I think the chairman of Manpower called it a sluggish hiring situation. So
That's
the
right.
takeaway from this is unemployment may be better in the president's eyes, but in fact, it could get worse.
That's right.
Louise Story from The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us, Todd.
All right. Thanks, Lynn. Let's turn to London now. Investigators say it could have been the most devastating attack since September 11th. Now a court in London has found three British Muslim men guilty of conspiracy to murder, by plotting 3 years ago to blow up planes over the North Atlantic bound for America. The men planned to use liquid explosives disguised as soft drink bottles, and that the men could have smuggled them on board at least seven airliners. The BBC's defense and security correspondent Rob Watson has been following the case and joins us now. Rob, how are you?
Good morning, Todd. I'm good, thanks. Busy day.
Yeah, indeed. Rob, this case is the reason why we're not allowed to bring soda cans, liquid water bottles onto planes anymore, correct?
That's absolutely right. This plot changed air travel for, well, potentially forever.
Forever. 3 ounces, I guess, is the limit now because of the hydrogen peroxide, I believe it was. What was the chemical they were...
I always get confused about what
Me
it
too.
Is that you're supposed to take on planes, so I always end up getting into trouble at airports. But in terms of the intended explosive they were going to use, as you say, it was going to be injected into a bottle, and it would have been a mixture of hydrogen peroxide and a soft drink powder from Pakistan called Tang.
Tang. So these three gentlemen convicted, but this is not the first time they had been on trial. I mean, these guys have been in the news for a long time.
That's right. There was a first trial last year, and what happened there was that a jury convicted them of attempted murder using liquid explosives. But where the jury was hung was on this issue of had it been a specific plot to target transatlantic airliners. And the government felt that this was such a huge plot, that it was so important, that they decided to have a retrial on that charge. And this time, of course, the jury did convict them. And I can't tell you the level of relief that there is with the British authorities, both in terms of the government and the counter-terrorism forces, because they really feel as though this conviction makes the point that they're not exaggerating the threat, that there is a real threat, and they're not just randomly arresting the occasional Muslim fantasist.
And there was a lot of tension, however, between American intelligence services and the British authorities surrounding this very case.
Very much so, and more about that has emerged since the verdicts came through. And essentially, I guess if one was to simplify it, the version that the Brits are giving is that the United States was very, very edgy indeed the further the plot went on, and was keen that the authorities should move, for fear, of course, that there would somehow that they would escape the radar, an attack would be carried out, and then you would have had all the kind of Monday morning quarterbacking of, well, why on earth didn't you do something? These people are under surveillance. So
right.
the Brits feel as though the American side was a little bit jumpy, because ideally what they would have liked is for the plot to have gone on a little bit longer, so as perhaps they could have convicted even more people and gathered even more intelligence about other people connected with Islamic extremist violence.
Rob, just a couple seconds here. I just want to ask you quickly. You mentioned two trials. We have the concept of double jeopardy here in the United States. Why retrying them for the same thing again? Why was this not double jeopardy quickly?
It's not double jeopardy because they weren't acquitted. It was just a hung jury. It couldn't decide whether they were guilty or not guilty.
Rob Watson, defense correspondent for the BBC, joined us to talk about the conviction of three accused terrorists in London, the liquid bombers. Thank you for joining us. Now let's check in on today's top news stories.
Todd, aides say President Barack Obama will get specific tomorrow when he gives his big healthcare speech. He's expected to declare it's time to move from debating to voting. Obama meets today with top congressional Democrats. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber struck an airport in Kabul today. Afghan officials say the blast killed several civilians. NATO forces have a base at the airport.
Firefighters are fighting to stop the spread of a huge wildfire north of Los Angeles. The fire is now more than 50% contained. It's burned through nearly 250 square miles of land.
And those are some of the top stories we're watching today. Coming up, Nevada was one of the hardest hit areas when the economy collapsed. So how is life there now? On the Mend, we'll find out in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is Todd Zwillick with Lynn Scherwer filling in for John Hockenberry this morning.
So you don't complain. You stay grounded in your belief, and you know that things are going to get better, and you be prepared and ready when opportunity comes. And you just got to make sure that you have the right attitude, positive attitude.
That was Nevada resident Janice Birch speaking with our partners, the BBC. Janice is one of the many voices recorded in a BBC series called Aftershock. It's a close-up look at how people around the world are holding up 1 year after the events that led to the current recession. As part of the series, Steve Evans, the host of our partner, the BBC show Business Daily, went to Nevada to chronicle lives impacted by this recession. Steve joins us here in studio on his way back from London. Joining us from Nevada, Steve?
From Nevada, yeah. On the way, a little bit in New York, but yeah, on the way back to London.
A little stopover. You can't fly direct to London.
Absolutely not.
All right, Steve, well, thanks for being with us. So we've officially got 9.7% unemployment across the country, and that doesn't account for, as we just discussed earlier, that doesn't account for underemployment and people who aren't looking anymore. The numbers are much worse than that. What's the situation on the ground in Nevada right now? How do things stand for people in that economy?
Rate of unemployment in Nevada is 13%, which is a bit odd because
it is huge,
but it should be higher in a way, because the thing about Las Vegas is when people lose work, they go back home. So if you like, if the rate of unemployment is 13.1%, which it is, actually that means an awful lot more people have lost work, because you lose work in Las Vegas, you go back wherever you came from.
So
it's hurting.
People who've lost work, they've gone home. Came to work in the hotel or the casino or something like that.
Croupiers, whatever. So that's 13% of the people still there, the workforce still there. So it's high, and it's hurting there.
All right, well, what impression did you get from the people around there that you were talking to? I have to assume it was a mixture of hospitality workers, service workers, casino workers, people like that.
We did what we'd call in Britain upstairs, downstairs. In other words, the strip, you know, the great big glitzy strip. But also downstairs Las Vegas, the people who live in North Las Vegas. And you get a lot of despair, lots of tensions coming out. For example, a big public hospital there in Las Vegas is currently dialyzing illegal immigrants, people without the papers, because now with unemployment going up, an awful lot of people with kidney problems are simply saying, I'm about to die. You have an obligation by law to treat me. You cannot turn me away.
And that can't be a politically popular situation.
It cannot be. There's a big row about it. So the big public hospital there, for example, has a ward full of illegal people, people who shouldn't be in the country or haven't got the right papers to be in the country, but they're on dialysis. Now, if you talk to the people in that hospital, they say, hold on a minute, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. There are kidney units in this city, but we are now treating people like that. And meanwhile, we're looking at staff costs and talking about laying people off because we've got a deficit. So there's a huge political tension brought up by this recession. And I imagine that kind of tension is cropping up pretty well everywhere.
Pretty well everywhere. Well, you talk to a guy named Ed Lee. He's probably suffering as hard as anybody can in this recession. He was an executive chef who lost more than just his job. And I want to hear from him now.
My last job was formatting a restaurant and a lounge, January of 2009. That was my last day of work. From then on, the house is foreclosures, just no work out there, couldn't pay the bills, just ended up on the street.
So Ed Lee from executive chef to homeless person at this point.
To the street.
To the street.
Now, he's currently in a hospital organized by the Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada, but, you know, the thing has hit him very, very badly, and he's somehow survived, and he's sort of saying, well, I'm going to get work, but you ask him where, and he doesn't quite know. He's a very, very down man, an invigorating man in lots of ways, because he's trying to pick himself up. He's doing all he can to pick himself up, but it's hard.
All right, we should add, of course, that in times like this, not everybody is in dire straits, and not everybody in your documentary is in dire straits. I think of places like the dollar store, places like Walmart are doing as well as ever because people need to save money and they go to those places. Well, you talked to a gentleman named Glenn Parshall. He's a pawnbroker. I want to hear from him and have you comment on Glenn.
People are coming in and selling everything. They're coming in and selling their jewelry. They're coming in and selling their silverware sets, the tools, TVs. Business is very good. It's been rolling along. We're getting a lot more people in. They're getting loans in as well.
That's one man's treasure. Glenn's doing just fine.
Glenn's doing very well indeed. And Glenn's doing doubly well. He's a pawnbroker, and he deals mostly in guns. And what he says is that high unemployment is good for him on two counts. One, because unemployed people want to pawn their guns because it's valuable. But also he says there's more fear out there, so people want to buy guns. He's doing very well indeed in this recession. He's a great big bear of a man with a great big beard. He's a very interesting character.
So he's got the guns coming and going. The poor folks want to get rid of them, and the people who have something to defend want to come and buy them.
That's right.
Well, he's some way to be a middleman in this economy, isn't it?
It's a great business.
Yeah. Well, what about the casinos? We're talking about Vegas. We have to talk about the casino business. Are they way down? I mean, I would have to think in this recession, people just don't want to gamble.
Ish. Let me give you the figures, Todd. Visitor volume in the last month, for which there are figures, down 6%. Average daily room rate down 25%, so it's a good time to go there. Convention attendance down 19%. And that, they say, is basically because of the opprobrium that companies had. They didn't want to be seen to be having fancy conventions in Las Vegas while the local press were there. So the numbers are all down. There's also a bit of anger there, I think, amongst the people who run the casinos. There's a great big development in the center of Las Vegas. They're trying to build this huge complex of shops and apartments and hotels and whatever. And they ran out of finance, basically, or they needed refinancing about a year ago. And they say, the people who run this thing say, if you wanted to talk to a bank a year ago, they just didn't want to know. And they were scampering around like mad things, trying to get this finance going while the market had frozen. And they're very, very angry at Wall Street. They think that Wall Street let them down when they were actually trying to keep things going.
Where's the project at right now?
The project is going on, and you can hear it going on, but you have to say, you look at those apartments and say, how are they going to fill that stuff? The property market is clearly very, very different, and it's clearly going to be a struggle.
And Steve, you seem to think that Nevada is representative of what's going on in this country.
Nevada is not representative, obviously. Las Vegas is very, very one-off. But having said that, all economies, it's a kind of a barometer for lots and lots of things. You know, people spend their money on leisure, clearly. And if they're feeling it's all a bit tight, then that gets pulled in. So it's a very, very good barometer of what's happening in everywhere else.
All right. Steve Evans of the BBC, host of our partners show, The Business Daily, is doing a new documentary, a new series called Aftershock. He's just been to Las Vegas. He's on his way back to London. Steve, thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome.
All right, now let's take a look at today's top news stories.
Aides say President Obama will declare it's time to move from debating to voting in his big health care speech tomorrow. Today, he meets with top Democrats in Congress. Firefighters are trying to stop the spread of a huge wildfire north of Los Angeles. The fire is now more than 50% contained. Overseas in Afghanistan, an election commission has ordered a recount of presidential election votes at many polling stations. They say there is clear evidence of fraud. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Coming up, what is the biggest health issue facing the world? It could be depression. We'll talk more about that story in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. The eighth day of the U.S. Open will be in full swing. Yesterday on day seven, 17-year-old Melody Udan celebrated yet another victory, this time defeating Russia's Nadia Petrova. And she was sounding very confident after her win over that Russian.
Mentally, I'm staying in there with them the whole time, and I'm not giving up at all. And so if they're going to beat me because I'm not going to go anywhere.
All right, here with the latest from Flushing Meadows in Queens is Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
All right, so Petrova was not the first Russian, not even close to the first Russian that Melanie Udan has knocked off. I had the chance to be there on Saturday when Udan took down Maria Sharapova. She's just absolutely phenomenal at this point.
Right now, she's playing with incredible confidence, as you pointed out earlier. But what she represents, I think, in terms of tennis and what it means for the Americans, she is the American hope right now on the court. Even the American John Isner went down yesterday in four sets, and he played great tennis, but he was literally the last American male that was playing tennis in the U.S. Open. And for the first time ever in the Open history, an American male will not make it to the quarterfinals.
Right, like 120 years or
Correct,
something like
yeah.
that. All right, well, the amazing thing about Maria Udan, her age, you know, she's just 17, of course, but her size, I mean, she's a 5'4" young lady playing against, you know, Sharapova is 6'3". She's playing against these gigantic women in comparison to her. How is she managing to outpace them on the court?
Well, I think she's playing with a quickness, and so she's quick with the racket, but also her footwork is incredible. If you look at the way she comes up and down and her lateral movement, it's a really outstanding, and especially for a younger player, she recovers quicker. A lot of the other players are getting beat up by the long season, beat up by the hard courts, and I think she's wearing it well.
You know, if this were the Cold War, they'd be calling her like the Russian killer, right? Hasn't she beaten like three or four Russians?
She certainly has. She beat Elena Dmitrieva, who was actually a favorite to win it. She beat Maria Sharapova, and then she beat Petrova. So the question is, who's next, and who else could be next? I think for her, everyone that she's going to face from now on is going to be easier than who she's faced now before. So her road now going towards the finals is paved clear. Let's see if she has what it takes.
Well, what was Nasky? Do I have it right? The one that she faces next?
I believe so. Yes.
And she's only 19.
And that's therein lies the rub, right? So you wonder what is going to happen when it really hits the fan right there, when she faces another person who has that heart and that grit. And this is what we love about tennis. This is what we love about her. If you walked by her on the street, you wouldn't know who she was. No. You wouldn't know who, you know, she's not rich. She's not powerful. She's the reason why we love sports.
She's all heart at this point.
110%.
It's like it is the true sweetheart story because she's all heart at this point.
It's the Melody Udan story.
Right. the glaring gap in this conversation, Ibrahim, is the men's side, which, you know, Federer rolled over yet another opponent yesterday, and the men's side hasn't been making a whole lot of sparks so far.
There's nothing going on in the men's side. I mean, Federer looks unbelievable. And I was mentioning Eisner yesterday just because it was significant that he was the last American male standing. But even his game was very typical of where the Americans are at now. He's large, he's towering, he's big. He doesn't have great side-to-side movement. His game is really like, if he can charge up quickly, he can make a good shot, he'll make it. But really, he was proven like he was stuck in the mud, and he lost.
We got 20 seconds. We have to get an update on the Williams sisters. Where are Venus and Serena at?
Well, Venus is out. Venus has lost, and people are wondering where she's at. Serena's like Roger Federer. I would rather see them two play against each other.
All right, so she's headed for the final. All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, bringing us up to date on Flushing Meadows, Queens, and the story of Melody Udan, who plays tomorrow. Indeed. She's 17, and she's got a 19-year-old next.
Yes, good morning.
Can't wait.
I'm Lynn Scherr, and with Todd Zwillick, coming up, depression could be the biggest issue that the world faces, according to the World Health Organization. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. We're also talking all day about President Obama's speech to school children. It's still causing controversy in some circles. We want to know where you stand.
My name is Leon Williams from Lubbock, Texas. I very much am in favor of it. I happen to be an African American, and in my area, the African American students are behind the other ethnic groups. What better motivational tool can we have but to have an African American President Obama address the youth?
Tell us your take on the president's speech to school children, and if you're a parent, will you let your kid listen? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now some of the other news stories we're following this morning. The president is trying to break the logjam in Congress over health care. He's meeting with top Democrats in the Oval Office today ahead of his national health care speech tomorrow night. He's expected to say it's time to stop debating and start voting on a plan. According to a new study for our partners, the BBC, fewer migrants are looking for work in other countries because of the global recession. The study shows the number of Mexicans moving to the U.S. has fallen by 40% since 2006.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon has accepted the resignation of General Eduardo Medina Mora, the attorney general who was leading the battle against the drug cartels. The attorney general's image was tarnished by charges that his top confidant was taking bribes. GM might not be rid of Hummer just yet. Chinese Commerce Ministry wants more details on a bid to sell Hummer to a Chinese manufacturer. Chinese authorities have to approve that deal. And in other business news, McDonald's can't lay claim to all McCompany names. That's what a Malaysian court said when it ruled the Malaysian chicken chain McCurry could keep its name. McDonald's argued that the Mick in McCurry was a trademark infringement. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Okay, Todd, it is Tuesday, and that means we're talking about health. Doctors from all over the world are returning home today from the first global mental health summit, which took place over the weekend in Athens, Greece. A major focus, depression. The World Health Organization predicted last week that depression will become the biggest health burden on society, both economically and sociologically, within the next 20 years. Joining us to discuss this is Dr. Shekhar Saxena, who manages the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse for the World Health Organization. We're also speaking with Carrie Cooper, a professor of psychology and health at the University of Lancaster in England. First, Dr. Saxena, welcome to you.
Thank you.
When we hear WHO, we often think of diseases like malaria and HIV, but WHO considers depression such a serious problem now, nationwide, worldwide. Why is that happening, and how do the numbers compare, say, to HIV or HIV/AIDS?
Well, malaria and HIV are definitely very serious conditions, and there is no doubt about that, and WHO is focusing attention on that. However, depression is also a very common disease and also very burdensome. And WHO believes that the burden because of depression is already high and is going to increase in the coming years. So countries and communities need to pay much more attention to a condition like depression than they did earlier.
I understand that one of the reasons has to do with demographic change because of our aging population.
That's correct, because we as a population are aging, and depression is more common in middle and older age groups. So because of this demographic change, there will be increased incidence of depression amongst most communities.
And indeed, Dr. Saxena, one of the most startling things, and perhaps it's not so startling, is that depression is such a major problem in the developing world. Let's listen to this clip. This is a Kenyan woman, Susan Catherine Cater, and she suffers from depression.
In Kenya, issues to do with mental health are not understood, and there's a lot of stigma. People always believe that you cannot have a mental condition unless you've done something wrong.
Dr. Saxena, why is depression so stigmatized, and what are the special problems in the developing world?
Well, unfortunately, the story from Kenya is not an isolated one. In most developing countries, mental disorders in general and depression in particular is not being paid attention because nobody wants to talk about it. It's, I would call, a silent epidemic. It's large, but totally untalked about. And even governments are spending far less money than they should to control these kind of problems. And the causes are in the communities, in the families, and in our own psyche. We don't want to talk about things that we feel we are ashamed of, which is completely a myth. We need to change that.
And speaking about money, Professor Carrie Cooper from University of Lancaster in England, what is the economic cost of having so many depressed people worldwide?
Oh, it's absolutely enormous. The UK government did a study on mental capital and mental well-being, a two-year assessment of it. And we came to the conclusion, having looked at the figures and the economics of it, it was costing the UK economy about $110 billion per annum. And this mostly made up of common mental disorders, which are depression, anxiety, and so on. It really has become a big problem in the developed and developing world. And I think if you look at the sources of it, the reasons why it's become a big problem, it's not just the demographics. I certainly agree the demographics are one element of it, because dementia, we're living longer and therefore more likely to get dementia, and it's very costly to treat people and to sustain people and support people who have dementia. But think about it, in the developed world in particular, constant change, recession, globalization, job insecurity, financial insecurity. And then, of course, as people move around to get jobs, they miss the kind of social support systems they had in their communities and extended family. And therefore, when they have problems, they don't know who to turn to. They used to turn to their grandmas, their aunties, people around them in their community who they knew, who in a sense provided the social support for minor depression, anxiety-related illnesses. They no longer have that because they're looking for jobs or having to go further afield. So these changes have led to this kind of a problem area.
This kind of disruption. We're listening to Carrie Cooper, professor of psychology and health at the University of Lancaster in England, talking about depression as a worldwide problem. I'm Lynn Scherr. Todd Zwillick joining me, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Todd?
Dr. Cooper, Dr. Saxena, I'd like to briefly hear from both of you. Is treatment even an option here? I mean, with other diseases like HIV, for instance, it took years and years to even start to get people in the developing world treated. Whether it's drugs or counseling or a combination of both, for most people in the world, is treatment as we know it even an option? Dr. Cooper?
Yes, very much.
Dr. Saxena, go ahead.
Yes, very much so. Treatment is very much possible. In fact, depression is one of the most common conditions which can be very effectively treated. And as you said, by using medicines which are available and safe.
But my question is getting treatment to these people in very poor parts of the world. Not that it's effective, but getting it to them.
That I think is the difficulty. The treatment is available, particularly in the developed world. There's absolutely no problem. In the developing world, that becomes much more a problem, particularly as I think we said earlier about the stigma associated with mental ill health. There are two elements here. One is the treatments, which are available and are very effective for a lot of the common mental disorders. The other issue is prevention. How do we look at the sources of what causes people to get depressed in the first place? And if you take a look at in the work environment, for example, where you get a lot of mental disorder in the work environment, the work creating it, it's a way people are managed. It's about the level of job security. It's about identifying it early enough. So we also have to do prevention work in the communities and the workplace to try to minimize the kind of problems. Even in dementia and Alzheimer's, we need to identify it and have the biomarkers and ways of identifying dementia early enough so that we can use the medications and the treatments to create so we don't have the long-term impact of dementia, which can be devastating.
And Dr. Kerry Cooper, Professor of Psychology and Health at the University of Lancaster in England, Dr. Shekhar Saxena at the World Health Organization, I assume you consider it a major first step that the conference in Athens actually discussed depression at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely essential. We really have to tackle this. Common mental disorders should be high up the international agenda. It is not only costly to the individual and their families, but to a range of countries throughout the world.
And that's the takeaway on depression. Kerry Cooper, Professor of Psychology and Health at the University of Lancaster in England, and Dr. Shekhar Saxena, Program Manager, Department of Mental Health, World Health Organization.
All right, you can follow us all day online at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can talk with us about President Obama's speech later today to school kids. It's still causing a lot of controversy in some circles, so where do you stand?
Yes, hi, this is Joe from Valley Stream, and I think this whole thing of the president addressing the American school children is a big nothing. As a matter of fact, my wife was wondering, didn't like H.W. Bush address the students way back when?
8778-MY-TAKE. The email is mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's another view.
I believe that normally our presidents are supposed to be role models for our children, and we allow sports players and movie stars to be role models, and we can't allow our president to be a role model. That to me is very surprising.
Do you think the president's a role model? Do you think he's being paternalistic or trying to be the nation's father? Let us know, 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Lynn Scher.
It's The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.